Hello, I'm Dan Le Batard, and joining us today will be Luther Campbell. He's a Miami institution for a lot of different reasons. If you're not familiar with Two Live Crew and the way that Two Live Crew went to the Supreme Court on a freedom of speech situation, you're going to be fairly amazed by what happens next, because he is an unlikely hero in this story. He is not exactly someone that you would associate with freedom of speech before he went to the Supreme Court, but he's got a ton of stories about a ton of different things in hip hop that you're going to find revealing, including people who were afraid to step into Miami unless they got a pass from Luther Campbell. So we'll talk to him in a second. But first, in order to keep these things free, we need a couple of things from you. We need you to rate, review, subscribe. That's three things, but it's under the umbrella of one thing. And then we need you to support our sponsors. In this case, it's ZipRecruiter. And Mike Ryan, tell the people about ZipRecruiter and what it is that they get. Just do it off the top of your head, please. I don't want you reading bullet points or doing something that's too broadcastery. Just off the top of your head.
Hiring is challenging, but there's one place you can go where hiring is simple, Dan. Fast and smart. A place where growing businesses can connect to qualified candidates, and that place is ZipRecruiter.com/beach.
We need the beach. We need the beach in there on everything that people are doing so we get the credit for it. We're fairly shameless about that. But again, off the top of your head, please, we don't want any reading here. Those canned reads are annoying.
As applications come in, ZipRecruiter analyzes each one and spotlights the top candidates so you never miss a great match. ZipRecruiter is so effective that 80% of its employers who post on ZipRecruiter get quality candidates through the site within the first day.
First day.
Within the first day.
Not the second day.
How efficient
is it? Not the third day. The first day.
And right now, South Beach Session listeners, I don't know why
what
I sounded,
happened just what happened.
I sounded like Adam Schefter. And right now,
do
South
the rest
Beach Session
of it
listeners.
As Adam Schefter.
And right now, South Beach Session listeners can try ZipRecruiter for free at its exclusive web address. According to my sources, that web address is ZipRecruiter.com/beach. That's ZipRecruiter.com/beach.
We are going to lose this sponsor to the Adam Schefter podcast.
I'm spelling right now.
Because that sounds so
according
good.
According to my sources, I'm spelling.
Let's
beach.
Get, please, to Luther Campbell. And remember that ZipRecruiter is the smartest
the
way to
I'm talking over the tag. ZipRecruiter.com/beach. B-E-A-C-H. ZipRecruiter. Just smartest way to hire.
Here's Luther Campbell. I've known this guy for a long time. I have had early on some public feuds with him that were funny and wonderful. And now I've grown over the years to admire him, not just because he was a symbol a million years ago for all the great Miami stuff where he took our music to the Supreme Court, but then later in life to see him actually grow up and become a mature adult after having the raunchiest 80s and 90s of anyone in the history of Miami, to have this guy come in and now work with LeBron James on a docuseries about the Warriors of Liberty City. Luther Campbell's put a lot of people in the pros through that program, caring about kids that not a lot of people care about. And LeBron James saw that and decided to chronicle it because he's all about empowering his friends, empowering black people. So Luther Campbell's with us here, and I just want to talk about his career. But first, this series that you're doing on Stars with LeBron James, he saw all those things, right?
Yeah,
he saw what I'm talking about.
Yeah, during his time here, I mean, you know, he heard about the program. You know, it was easy. When one of my good friends, Evan, pitched it to him, you know, it was like a no-brainer for him because he knew, you know, by living here, and having his kids here and his kids, you know, participating with a lot of these other kids in different sports, he understood the importance of football here in South Florida.
You come from a time, I was talking about this with somebody the other day, there are not a lot of movies that portray 80s and 90s Miami. It's sort of Scarface, it's whatever Billy Corbin puts out, mm-hmm. but there are not a lot of movies, Miami Vice, when it was popular on television. Like, what can you tell us about the early years in Miami, in the music scene in Miami?
Well, the early years, it's just like you say, you know, you can't, like, put your hand on a movie, whether it's Power or whether it's Empire, anything like that. It's like totally different. I mean, you're talking about in the early 80s, you know, when the music industry was pretty much, as far as hip hop, absolutely nothing. I mean, you had Betty Wright, you had TK Productions and all those.
But what was nothing? Explain to us what was nothing.
It was no such thing as hip hop in the South, period. You know, a lot of people don't realize that we started hip hop in the South because there wasn't no such thing as it being in Atlanta or anywhere else in the South. And so, you know, back then it was Cocaine Cowboys and the people who worked with the Cocaine Cowboys. It was crazy. I mean, it was people selling drugs on every street corner, you know, in Liberty City. And you know, at, you know, either you're a football player or you just got into the music business, which unfortunately I did.
So tell me how you grew up. Tell me what it looked like, where it was, what you remember. What are the details that you remember about the Miami that you've come to represent?
I grew up in Liberty City on 58 Terrace in 11th Avenue, in the heart of it, not too far from the Poke and Bean Projects, which is technically called Liberty Square Housing Projects. And all my friends lived in the housing projects, and my parents, you know, they grew up over town, you know, which is not too far from the arena. And, you know, we would go back and forth from those two different neighborhoods, you know. And when I grew up, you know, unfortunately, I got into music. You know, I would intern at radio station here, 99 Jams, and then I started out DJing. And from DJing, I started bringing groups down like Public Enemy and Run DMC and 2 Live Crew and groups like that.
So where were you bringing them? Where were you when you were bringing the biggest in hip hop? Where were you bringing them? And because you were a pioneer in terms of bringing that music down here.
Yeah. I mean, I would bring them to, you know, I would do high school dances because I was a DJ. I became like a big DJ in the neighborhood. So I would bring them either to whatever skating rink that we would have a party at on a Sunday. It may be a high school that we would have a party on.
So like you got Public Enemy or Run DMC at the height of what those groups are, and you're putting them in a skating rink in Miami.
Paying them $1,200. And a lot of the groups from New York, like Mantronics and Jazzy J and Tila Rock and all of them, they never got on airplanes. And that was the time of People with Express. I don't know if you that old to know about People's Express. The airline, you didn't see you.
No, I don't remember a People's Express. No.
Yeah. It was People's Express was an airline that used
before
to fly.
Eastern Airlines. Before Eastern
Airlines.
It was
around the time of Eastern, but what on People's, you were able to pay the money on the airline, like for the ticket.
Right there at the desk.
No, on the plane.
Okay, on the plane. No, just give cash. Pull it out of a suitcase and exactly. Hand it to the, okay. And what about that? Exactly. What does that have to do with what we're talking about?
But I would bring the guys down, but because I didn't know that they were going to actually show up. So I would tell them to get on the airplane and they wouldn't have the cash to pay. So I would be standing at the door and the police and I'd pay the airline.
What are you doing?
Hey, you know, I'm just being creative. I was a young guy being creative, but, you know, bringing those guys down, I learned a lot about the music business. You know, interning at the radio station, I learned a lot about the music business. So that's how I ended up getting into the business because they would tell me their problems and the struggles they went through.
Well, what were the struggles like before you landed on 2 Live Crew? And I want to get through that. Before you landed at success with 2 Live Crew, what did the struggles look like for you?
Well, the struggles, I mean, I grew up tough. I was, you know, all my brothers eventually ended up going to college. Fortunately, I had a mother and dad at the house and they preached education. You know, my mom, Bahamian and my dad Jamaican and they preached education in the household, but I was the bad guy. I was the dark shadow of the house. I stayed in trouble, went to jail quite a few times because I was hanging out with the wrong crew. And a lot of the times I was the leader of the wrong crew. So, you know, eventually I ended up getting into DJing. You know, finding my way there, you know, because obviously football didn't work out for me. I thought I was going to be this big time NFL football player, but I ended up going the wrong way and dealing with a lot of bad guys.
Well, what do you remember about that time? Because you and I haven't talked about the bad guys. I don't think I've ever had a conversation with you about like that time in Miami. That time, because if I tell you Bahamian Jamaican parents in Liberty City, that kid's gonna have a hard time getting out of that situation.
Yeah, no, you're gonna be working your tail off if you came from that kind of household. I mean, you know, just like any other kid, not any other kid, but you know, I ended up hanging out with the wrong crew of guys. You know, getting in a lot of trouble, hanging on the corner. You know, sold a little weed here and there, and. You know, and then I saw my friends dying and I saw people using the other drugs that was out there and they were either being cracked up or used up. I ended up going to jail for either selling drugs. I even dying for selling drugs because all these different drug holes at the time, you know, they were killing each other and all that. So, I mean, I had to make a decision as a kid. Fortunately, my mom sent me to stay in Washington, D.C. with my military brother. And that kind of straightened me out. I got to see African-American people in D.C. doing things that I didn't get to see here in Miami. You know, I saw people riding around in Mercedes Benzes with suits on and briefcases and doing the right thing with their life. And then I just brought that knowledge that I achieved there to bring it down here and start getting into business.
But also street credibility, correct? Because yeah. The life you lived, right? Two Live Crew couldn't have been what it was if it didn't look so strange to people outside of Miami, right? It's
right.
Not like that. It couldn't have been the phenomenon that it was. Like, what are those guys doing? Why is everyone naked? Why is this so dirty? How is any of this allowed?
Yeah, ain't no doubt about it. Ain't no doubt about it. I mean, my first... When I came up with the idea of the Two Live Crew after, you know, because Two Live Crew was really, if you go back into the history and the archives, the first record was a conscience record. It was all about empowerment, you know, on the other side.
I didn't know that about it. Wait a minute. You got Two Live Crew, the initial incarnation was going to be Public Enemy and sort of a politics band?
Yeah. It was more like Common. It was more like Common.
What are you talking about?
They ended up coming down here with me. And you know, with me, before you know it, I had some security guys that worked at the skate ring. And they took me over to Tootsie's on 441. I'd never been in a strip club in my life. And they took me in there and just blew my mind. It opened me up to a whole nother world of sexuality. So I just say, I told the Two Live Crew, look, we're going to do some X-rated music, and we're going to shoot some videos down here on South Beach of the girls running around half naked, and that's how we ended up becoming Two Live Crew.
But take me through the beginning, then, of Two Live Crew. What was that like at the very beginning? Like, did the group struggle at all in terms of trying to get people to notice it?
Yeah. I mean, at the beginning, like I said, me being a DJ, what I would do when you're a local DJ, you would have, you know, you'll be a member of a record pool. And in that record pool, they would send you tons of records. As a DJ, I wanted to be different than everybody else. I didn't want to play the same records that was played on the radio. I always wanted to break records, and I always thought that that's how you needed to be a great DJ. And so I found their record in the stack of records. They wasn't really popular anywhere. And then, you know, because I'm DJing in front of anywhere between 4,000 and 5,000 people throughout the weekend.
Because the party has followed you all your life, right?
Yeah.
For 30 years, you're the party promoter. More than that, 40 years, the party always follows you.
We'll do a party on Friday at a junior high, about 1,000 kids, and then we'll go to a senior high in the gymnasium, another 1,500 on Sunday.
Just hustling. That's all you're doing.
So I'm bringing these artists down, and these artists are telling me these horror stories about them not getting paid. So before you know it, Two Live Crew comes down. They're on Mercola Records, the same label that Ice Cube and all the rest of those guys were on, which was a distribution company. And so these guys, not knowing that they were in the military at the time, because both Chris and David was in the military and Yuri was in the military at the time, you know, and they couldn't really promote around the country because they were really illegally coming out doing a show. They would just take off a weekend. So I ended up saying, hey, look, in order for you to become a bigger name, we're gonna have to do something with this conscious rap and this party music. We're gonna need to change it. Sample some Dolemite and some Leroy Skillet and some Red Fox. You know, let's make some nasty music.
Mm-hmm.
And so we ended up making some nasty music. First song was Throw the Dick, and that just went bananas. Got me in jail. Everything.
All right. Well, hold on. We'll get to that in a second. We'll get to getting you in jail in a second. But as you guys are doing this, like, when do you realize, when's the point that Two Live Crew realizes, oh, wait, we've really got something here. Now we've got something that we're doing something no one else is doing.
Well, when the PMRC called me up, when Tipper Gore and the PMRC put me on a list and said the top 10 raunchy, no good rappers, entertainers, you know, I'm on there with Guns N' Roses and all these people. I'm like, these are big time stars on here. And when I got put on that list, I knew right then. When the governor of the state of Florida, Martinez, when it said these guys need to be banned. I knew we had arrived, and Dan Quayle, the vice president, say, Luther Campbell and the Two Live Crew needs to be banned. I was like, oh shit, this is real right now. This is real. Even though I'm selling records out the trunk of my car.
Yeah, when the vice president is saying something, now I'm messing with the government, and that has not gone well for my people over the years.
Exactly. We always lost that fight. You know what I'm saying? We lost that fight. So when I start seeing all that, and then I'm on Phil Donahue's show and all these different shows stating my case, making my argument, it was like, oh, man.
It was funny to watch. I remember growing up around it and being like, all of this is so very Miami. But it didn't seem like you were scared, because I remember in watching you during that time as people are being like arrested at record stores and the Supreme Court. Yeah. Like, it's just all this nonsense. And I remember that you didn't, like, you'd be smiling all the time as you're being led out of a record store or something. It didn't seem like it was bothering you a whole lot.
No, it wasn't bothering me at all. Because again, you know, I grew up with my uncle and my dad, and they would tell me the history of the United States of America. And they would tell me the power that when people achieve certain power, and by achieving power, people listen to you. When you get people to listen to you, you become a target, but you didn't have to know how to handle that. So everything that anybody had did to me, whether it was taking me to jail or taking me to court or for whatever it was, I kind of already predicted that that was going to happen, because I wasn't at the time, again, affiliated with no major record company. I had no backing at anybody. I was selling these records out of the trunk of my car. So I was an easy target. So I knew all these things were going to come.
Was there any beef between Regions and Miami, or was Miami able to stay out of all of the hip-hop beef of the time?
No, it was, we had beef one time with Snoop Dogg, which is my friend right now. You know, the Suge Knight. He was beating up every record executive and talking trash to every record executive, and he pretty much punked everybody. But then when it came around to him having a conversation with me, that became a problem. Because, you know me, my former life was a street guy. I was a tough guy. So, you know, I was like, no, you went to UNLV, played football. I'm really a tough guy. I just rap about girls and parties because I don't want to rap about the things that I've been through in my life. So Snoop did a record. And we did a record called Cowards in Compton, and it ended up in a big melee in Atlanta. It ended up in a big fight. A lot of people got beat up and things like that.
Well, I think you told me one time that Suge was not allowed to come in Miami unless
none of
he
them.
Checked with you. No one in the Suge Knight crew
none
was allowed.
No Snoop Dogg, no Dr. Dre, none of them.
That they weren't allowed in Miami unless you specifically godfathered them in.
Right. I had to give them a ghetto pass. None of them.
Because you had some real thugs in your crew, right?
Yeah,
like you had some real dangerous people in your crew.
Like
Suge Knight got beat up by a hairdresser. I'm not saying he's not dangerous, but a hairdresser punched him out, right? Punched him out not that long ago, knocked him out. You weren't scared of this person.
Oh, no. No. See, my former life was real bad guys. It was real bad guys. I remember that's when I kind of made the transition from the streets, even though I thought I made the transition. But when these bad guys from my former life heard that there was some beef with me and Snoop Dogg and Suge Knight and all these people, and we were all going to Atlanta for this convention, music convention, and these guys just showed up on the doorstep and was knocking on the door. Hey, look, we here to take care of this Snoopy Dogg issue. And I was like, well, what y'all talking about? There's no issue. Not you all. And
we don't need to raise the stakes up to here. Snoopy Dogg doesn't want any of that.
Yeah, I'm like, no, it's not that serious. It's not that serious. It's just, you know, it's just chatter. And they were like, no. Nobody talks to us like this. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, no, chill. And they was like, get something to eat. Okay. So they, you know, I remember it like it was yesterday.
So do you tell Snoop you saved his life? Do you tell him you saved his life?
I haven't told him this story yet. I saved his life. And they were like, okay, get something to eat. These dudes, I'm like, how did y'all get here? You know, did y'all, no, we drove here. We got the tools in the car. What tools? I'm sitting up here like, what tools? No, I'm sitting up here at the Ritz-Carlton in Atlanta. I'm like, what? No, we're not doing that. And it was like, order some food. And they were like, okay, they ordered steaks. And they was like, make sure you bring steak knives. I'm serious. Like, I swear on everything. I'm like, steak night? What we finna do? No, and then we end up going to the convention, and it was, and let me tell you, Cortez Kennedy was with me. He was holding out from the Seattle Seahawks. And Cortez was like, oh, I'm gonna hang out with you in Atlanta, and all. I used to see Cortez running through the lobby. They were tearing up, they tore up the whole Marriott Marquis.
You, I was supposed to meet you in Atlanta, and our paths got crossed the night that Ray Lewis had that happen to him. Everything that happened there with, I remember distinctly Ray Lewis being afraid of some of the Miami people he was involved in.
Yeah, yeah. Ain't no question about it. Yeah, and me and Ray stayed at the same hotel because we all were going out the same night. And he showed up to my door. I had this new girlfriend that I was trying to be my girlfriend. I'm trying to settle down. And he showed up to the door, and the girl was like, this is what you hanging out with? He had this big mint coat on. This guy's a pimp. I'm like, no, that's Ray Lewis. And she didn't understand. She didn't know nothing about no football. And it was like, because he showed up to my door with this big mink coat on all the way down to his ankles, I couldn't go out. Other than that, I would have been in the car. I would have been in that car with him. And I know all the guys that was in the car with him. And some of them are some real tough guys. And, you know, some of them got their life in order right now, and some of them incarcerated.
You have seen a lot over your life in Miami and in hip hop. When you talk about these kinds of things, what is the most scared that you have been? Because you can't always be fearless, right? Not especially where it's escalated now to where it's escalated since then, and all the years where, you know, everybody's shooting each other.
The most scared I've been, I guess I would say when my son was born.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, when you're sitting there and you're thinking about, is the umbilical cord going to choke him? You know, you're getting ready to have this kid and these complications are happening with my wife. You know, that was the most scared out. I mean, on the streets, I think I was more like General Patton. I was standing up and guns shooting and melees going all around me. And that I didn't really flinch on that. But when it was time to have my son, I was nervous.
Why wouldn't you flinch on that, though? What was it?
I don't know. It was just something. It was probably something in my DNA. It just, melees always happen around me.
Well, what happened with the Snoop one? How did you guys repair all of that? Like, how bad was that one, and how did you repair all of it? Because he's your friend now, right?
Yeah, that's my good friend. No, I think we came together because it had gotten blown out of proportion, obviously, and me and him had a conversation. Me and Suge had a conversation, and we repaired it actually when they had the Super Bowl here, and I invited them down. They came down for the Super Bowl. They hung out at my suite, and that was it. From that on, we was cool. But the repair of any beef is when the other party have both parties have respect for each other. You can't repair nothing if one party is soft and the other party don't have any respect for the other person.
Can you take me through the details that you remember of getting the lyrics to the Supreme Court? Like just all of the stuff that you remember, the specifics of you're taking these lyrics and you don't know that it's going to be a fight for America. You, in fact, you didn't want to be the political activist. You were all about selling sex and funny.
Yep.
And next thing you know, you're headed to the Supreme Court with a smile on your face and a bandana on your head. Like take us through the details of all of that, because it had to be exhilarating. It had to be unlike anything you've known before or since.
Yeah. A lot of people don't know. It was, you know, I had two cases. One case where we went to jail in Broward County, and they took the record off the shelf, and they said they deemed the album obscene. So I ended up having to go to a court of appeals, and I got that case overturned. If I didn't get that case overturned, then that would have been precedent, and they could have just banned any record right now, a Lil Wayne, a Drake record, any record with explicit lyrics on it. You know, so I got that overturned, but then at the same time, I had another case running at that same time, which is with the Roy Orbison, Pretty Woman, whether that's parody and whether or not parody is protected by the First Amendment. So that case was running. You know, I'm in court. I'm thinking that's just a regular sample case, but it wasn't really.
You were paying a lot of lawyers at this point.
Paying a lot of lawyers.
Like you're paying lawyers, but the money's coming in as well? Like you're not worried about the amount of money that you're paying for lawyers right now?
No, at that time, because because I was, it was a good and bad situation. The good part of it, I was nationally known. Everybody was buying a record.
Everything that people want in music, they were talking about you.
Yeah, exactly. And they were buying records. And they were buying records. And, you know, unfortunately, I wasn't touring like I wanted to tour because there were no building wouldn't touch us.
But all the news stories, you are on every television with the news talking about this. So that is bringing in money. No, you can't pay for that. Yeah. But so take us through what's happening with these lawyers and how scared you are, or how you're feeling during this.
So my lawyer told me at the time, he was like, look, you're in a win-win situation with this because you're going to be a household name for the rest of your life. You're going to sell millions of records. You're going to always be known as the guy who fought for free speech. So it was like,
it's just whatever you pay me. The idea of you, though, the idea of booty music specifically, exactly. Of you being the guy, like, to be an American patriot on behalf of free speech, exactly. When all you wanted was money.
All I wanted was the cash. Give me the cash. I wanted to have a good time, party, rock and roll. Just give me the cash. Let me have a few.
Freedom fighter, exactly. Though. That's what you became, an American freedom fighter. Every top politician yelling about how scandalous you are for being sexual.
Exactly. Him, the guy. I was enjoying being a rock and roller. You know, I'm enjoying my sessions with the 3 and 4 girls in the bedroom and all that. I'm having a good time. But then one day wakes up and is, okay, you got to fight for free speech. So as that one case was going, the Roy Orbison case, it went through one court of appeals, the next court of appeals. Then before you know it, my lawyer was like, hey, look, this is going through the fourth district court of appeals. We got to go to Atlanta. I'm like, what the hell is the fourth district court of appeals? You know, I became a lawyer real fast.
Yeah, I can
real
tell.
Real fast. And then I'm sitting up in Atlanta, and it was like, okay, well, they then, you know, I won the case, and then they appealed it again. They won the case. Then they was like, okay, now this thing is going to the Supreme Court. What? I'm like, Supreme Court? Is that where we going? And it was, you know, before you know it, I went in the Supreme Court, and then I just know I'm going to get killed. I know I'm going to lose because at the time, Clarence – what his name?
Clarence Thomas.
Clarence Thomas was the.
I wanted to say Clarence Weatherspoon. Clarence Thomas is what.
I was gonna say Clarence Carter.
I wanted to say that.
And so he's sitting up in there. He just went through his little sexual escapade. So we're gonna lose him. He's not gonna vote for us. We got all these other justices up there, and that was a movie in itself. And then eventually we ended up winning. And what was surprising about that was you had Michael Jackson filing briefs against me. I'm like, hold on, not the black man filing a brief against me. And you had Dolly Parton filing briefs against me. And so, you know, but then in our favor, you had like Saturday Night Live and people like that. If I would have lost, you couldn't, no such thing as satire anymore.
I mean, satire would have been, right. Done. That's why you became a national issue, because it was more about the right to comedy, the right to parody. Mm-hmm. And so you go through all of that though. And how does your life change from that? Like from whenever that started and what your life was to what it became after that? What were those changes?
Like I said, yeah, good and bad changes. Because I was actually, because of the amount of records that I was selling with the other artists and the company that I had built, you know, I was basically set up to be, you know, another major record executive in New York. You know, it was a few of us. At the time it was me, Jimmy Iovine, and Craig Kalman. And we basically were set up to be the next guys that then replaced the Doug Morris and the Tunch Arams of the world. And when I went through that, you know, obviously a lot of people didn't like me fighting for free speech because I became the bad guy household name. So now when it was time for me to go and be the major record executive that I was supposed to be, these public traded companies wouldn't want to have anything to do with me.
You were radioactive, right?
Yes.
You were radioactive. You had become so popular, but so for something that was so vile in a repressed America that it was, there were parts of it that hurt your career.
Yeah. A lot of parts of it hurt my career. You know, just like I say, is you've been a household name for all the wrong reasons, but then when it was time for you to go into corporate America and do what you do best, and that didn't happen. So I pretty much stayed underground.
What are the specifics of the moment that you got the ruling in your favor? Like, what do you remember about, okay?
Oh, yeah. I was sitting there. I mean, I remember my lawyer giving me a call and saying, you ready? You're prepared for this, right? And then he ended up like, you got to sit down. You got to sit down. And then he told me I won. We won. And I was just ecstatic, emotional and everything. It was like a dream come true. One, that because of the fight and so long. And it was just, it was not just about the Roy Orbison fight. It was, I feel like I had won the fight for free speech and everything that they said about anything of my music, whether they put me in jail for and take my records off the shelf. I just felt like I was vindicated at that point.
I want to talk about how it is that you then got involved with the University of Miami, because this was scandalous. The University of Miami administration didn't know what to do with you, and the players loved you. You were supporting the players like you've always supported kids in this community, and it was fun to see the friction that you had with the University of Miami administration. What can you tell us about what you were doing at that time with players in terms of bothering the administration?
Bothering the administration. You know, I mean, I love football. I love University of Miami. But I was sitting at home one day, and I'm looking at the news, and I think it was probably Darrell Fullerton or somebody. One of the guys were on the campus shooting a gun. And then it was another story about one of the guys going to some of the dorm rooms and stealing from some of the kids. And then at that point, I was like, man, these kids are wasting the opportunity, because, again, I came from football, and I looked at my goal was to go to college and play football. And I know how difficult that is to achieve those goals. And so I looked at those kids, and me being a University of Miami fan, you know, I know at one point, you know, you only had the E.J. Bakers and the Kerry Bakers and a few guys being able to go to University of Miami, but a lot of guys going to Florida A&M at the time when I was growing up, because most guys weren't fortunate enough to go to University of Miami. They just wasn't having too many African-Americans down there. So I looked at it and said, these guys don't understand the opportunity that they have, you know, when they start bringing these kids down there from the inner city, because that wasn't heard of.
What Miami did. That's how how Miami got good, is that Howard somehow could go into the rough places.
Yeah. I mean, when Howard went, and I remember like it was yesterday when they went, because I went to the game, when they went and played Florida A&M at Dalt Campbell Stadium, and they got beat. Howard then took it upon himself to then start, you know, he looked at the roster and said, man, all these kids come from Miami. Because, fam, you had them been beating everybody. They beat everybody. I mean, it was to the point where they were getting ready to make them a D1 school. But then at the end of the day, I looked at it and saw these kids getting into all this trouble. And then I said, look, let me see if I can reach out to some of them and apply myself.
Hold on. This is funny, though. The idea, because this is not the way it ended up getting perceived.
No.
The way that you're presenting, it sounds very nice.
Mm-hmm.
Luther Campbell, as he's shown in life since, cares about kids, cares about football, cares about the lessons that football can impart upon kids. So you want to go in as a mentor.
Yeah.
But there's a crucifix that they're holding like you're a vampire when you're coming in, because you've also got a book where there's a golf club and you're sticking it into a part of a woman that you're not supposed to be sticking
exactly.
it into.
And they and don't
want, they don't want any of that near their program.
Exactly.
And so you're trying to mentor, but they're like, no, these are vile lyrics. We can't have this near our impressionable college kid.
And the first, one of my first album covers, I got the University of Miami jackets on with a pair of University of Miami underwear on top of my head and my pants hanging down with my UM drawers on and everything, standing in front of a Jeep Cherokee. Yeah, it was like, no, these are bad guys.
Well, you helped Miami. You know what's cool about you and this time, just like Ice Cube and those guys, NWA for Compton, like you helped Miami the way that it looked and felt and sounded, because that was a rebellious University of Miami mm-hmm. team that the country embraced because it was scary. And you knew how to put the Miami imprint on all of that. Like, you're partially responsible. I don't know what percentage you get for how popular those teams became because they were so rebellious.
Yeah, and that was the attitude. I mean, I think everything lined up at the right time, because my career, obviously, Miami then is now taking a road to not knowing what their identity was. And then when we put that stuff on, when we put those jackets on and we were singing, we want some pee and shake that ass and all that and face down ass up, and we started singing those songs, it became, now, okay, it was easy to gravitate to these guys. But then I was going to them, I told them all, I would sit there and have meetings with them guys on Thursday. Look, you don't know the opportunity that you have. I remember clearly taking the worst of the worst, the baddest of the badasses, and being their mentor. Jerome Brown was one of my main guys. These were real tough, bad guys. We would sit down and have a conversation about the opportunity that they have. But then, just like you say, being that me, the bad guy, and before you know it, now I'm standing on the sideline. And then people are like, hold on, this dude is on TV for singing obscene lyrics, and you got Al Gore's wife, you know, got him on his list. How the hell that happens? And before you know it, the perception of it is all bad, which I understand.
Well, what's funny about this is I can say honestly, from the moment that I met you, I have liked Luther Campbell, because I'm going to tell the story of when it is that I met you. I was a young reporter and I was scared. I didn't know what I was doing, and I had information on the University of Miami that I thought was great and funny and was a great story about players getting paid and Luther Campbell, you know, supporting kids in Miami as he has for many years. All of this was scandalous, and I was bringing it to Luther Campbell at the golf course. And
yeah.
I was a little bit scared because Luther Campbell's Miami was different from my Miami. And so I was just scared of everything. And I get there and I start asking you questions, and Luther Campbell is just bouncing a golf ball again and again with this giant smile on his face, finding all of it uproariously funny. And I just loved from back then your sensibilities on that stuff, because you realized it's all fun and games.
Yeah, it's all fun and games. It's all fun and games. I mean, and that was my way of, I'd obviously been doing thousands of interviews, and I would just try to throw people off. Like sometimes I'll have people come to my condo and they'll interview me like I did with the NCAA. They came to the condo, interviewed me about all this pay-for-play stuff, and I had naked girls running around the room and all that. It was like, you know, I always had to be funny.
So wait a minute. So when the NCAA came to interview you, you had basically a hip-hop video playing out in your house.
Naked women all around. Naked women was wrong. They was like, can you please tell? But it was my way of distracting the person who was asking the questions. So you got the ball, golf ball treatment. So I know it became an annoyance, so it threw you off from actually wanting to ask the right ones.
But one of the things, you have never admitted to any of the stuff that happened with the University of Miami that has been chronicled, and I'm not interested in getting you to admit it now. You weren't admitting it when I met you, and you've never admitted since. But what I want to ask you one question, just one question, and I'll move off the subject. It's a true or false question, and it's true or false. When there was bounty money on those University of Miami teams on an opposing player, whether it was the NFL guys putting together their money, if allegedly any of this happened, the money is put together to injure Notre Dame's top player. Was that money held by the team priest? True or false? The money that was put together.
Father Leo.
What?
Father Leo. Don't do that to Father Leo. See, Mike, that's when we had real football right there.
True or false? Father Leo was holding the bounty money.
Father Leo with the bag.
You had the bag of money. Father Leo had the bag of money.
Listen. Who was the only legal person that could take offerings? It was called offerings.
Oh, really? You guys were moving around the NCAA because they were offering?
Yeah, it was offerings to the church, to the pastor.
There you go.
You know, you give the pastor the offering. Hey, now what the pastor do with the offering, you know, he always come as you are, and he gives gifts to everybody.
Was that the most fun you were having when those University of Miami teams were good? The most fun before having, you know, before happily becoming happily domesticated and mature and married, the most fun you were having was those years.
Right? Oh, yeah. No question about it. Because, I mean, I was a kid that sat in the Orange Bowl when my brother would take me and I would finish my little Optimus game, and you come to the stadium with your uniform on, you get in free as me and 20 other people watching Nebraska and Notre Dame beat us to 78 and 59 and 100 to nothing. So I remember those days. And then when we got to the days where we started winning football games, and I'm sitting in the thick of it, orchestrating a lot of the the dance moves.
Oh, wait a minute. You guys, wait a minute. You were actually orchestrating the celebrations that got banned?
We orchestrated all that.
All of them. You
all
were doing
that was
it
Thursday night
them.
At my condo.
Do you have a favorite? I like the Horace Copeland backflip, but did you have any favorite? Did you have a favorite on any of the stuff that they were doing when they were doing your orchestrated dance celebration?
It was a lot of it was mine, but a lot of the guys got creative on their
You weren't home. Doing the Randall Hill stuff, were you?
Randall Hill just came up with, I love that one when he just took off through the tunnel. I mean, what happened is we put certain things together because they would make a rule, and then we would sit there and figure out how to get around the rule. Like Lamar Thomas taking his helmet off. You know, okay, they made a rule before that you couldn't do the dance, but then now take your helmet off. The world needs to see you. Go stand up in the stands with the helmet. So it was a lot of things.
Lamar Thomas was very good at taking his helmet off.
Yeah,
that was
yeah.
you being a bad influence. That was you being
No, that was me being a good influence. That we won then. It ain't like what we got going on now. This choir, this church we got over there. You know, we won back then.
You missed those days.
I missed those days.
Misogyny and violence and cocaine cowboys, Miami, and guns being shot in the dorms.
You could take the guns, but I missed the days of standing up over a guy and just dancing in his face. I missed them days of fighting, having the big brawls before the game. I'm looking at the LSU game, and there's only one guy want to fight. I was like, oh, we finna lose this game. I thought we were back. They keep selling we back. And it's only one guy fighting.
I want the whole team. I'm saying you want everybody throwing blows.
That's when we come back. That's when I know we're back.
Let me ask you some Miami questions here. The most Miami hurricane ever is, you can only pick one. You're only allowed to pick one.
Jerome Brown. No question about it. He created the University of Miami swag. He created everything about the university. I mean, they don't beat guys up in the shower no more, but. You know, Jerome Brown.
If I were to counter with Michael Irvin, though, as representing all things Miami, you would say?
I would say Michael Irvin gets the hype because Michael Irvin's on TV and all these different things. But Michael Irvin will tell you Jerome Brown was the heart and soul of the University of Miami.
We are getting old because guys like Jerome Brown and Cortez Kennedy are gone now. Do you remember the most heartbroken you were as someone who cares about the University of Miami and its football program to lose one of these guys?
Yeah, both of them. Because both of them was my very, very good friends. Both of them. I mean, Cortez, I watched his daughter grow up. Very, very, very emotional. My wife knows him. You know, it was never a day he wouldn't call me to tell me where he was at, whether he was out hunting in Arkansas, whether he was hanging out with the GM of New Orleans Saints, or he was going to Seattle to just watch a game. Both of those were my guys. And Jerome unfortunately passed because he was coming down to a celebrity golf tournament that I was having. So he was getting his car from the shop, and then he was test driving it to then head down this way, and he died before that.
Who was the scariest, Kane? I've heard some people were scared of Sean Taylor just because he could be a little bit off and he might beat them up. Who would you nominate for scariest?
Scariest? Winston Moss.
Okay, Winston Moss. Yes, he was muscles on top of muscle.
Winston Moss. The most scariest Kane ever. Everybody, when Winston Moss would go in the room,
he didn't say too much, too.
Everybody would shut up. Winston Moss was the most scariest Kane football player in the history. He would go in a room and you shut up. When it's time to shut up, you shut up. Winston Moss would beat guys down in the film room. If they played and they punked out on a play, Winston Moss would beat them down in the film room.
You've lived some crazy stuff because I remember when Benny and Brian Blades would get into a fight and they'd be throwing weights at each other in the weight room. That place was crazy.
No, that place was crazy. Yeah. That's how it should be. That's football.
That's not education. That's not higher learning.
No. No, it's not. Look. Let's keep it real. I mean, football is 1 year to 1 year contract. A lot of these kids think they have a 4 year deal, but if you don't perform, I remember that. I learned that from Jimmy Johnson. I was sitting in the locker room, and he was like, "Yo, you're not here to go get an education. You're here to play football." And I was like, "Okay." I'm sitting there like I don't understand what he's saying. I'm thinking they got a 4 year guaranteed ride. No, you have a 1 year with a 1 year option. I don't have to renew your scholarship next year. I can let you go. I was like, oh, shoot, this is serious. It isn't really not about education. It's about football.
Opened your eyes.
Yeah, it did. to this day right now, I educate kids on the same thing. No, you do not have a 4-year ride. You got to keep performing every year. Yeah, get your books, try to get an education out of it, but you got to play football.
Is there a Miami guy you've gotten to the pros that you're proudest of? Like, you've gotten a lot of them. What's the number? What's
the number? Oh, man, it's got to be about 20 right now, around 20. I had a kid last year go second round, Carlton Davis from out of Auburn. He played for me at Norland. And the year before that, I had Artie Burns. He played for me, went first round, Pittsburgh Steelers.
But is there any one story because of Devontae how personal Freeman. It is to you? What happened with Devontae?
Devontae Freeman played for me when my career slowed down. I went back to my youth program, Liberty City Optimist, and started coaching. He was not the most athletic kid. He was just, he just had a good heart. You know, that kid that just had a great smile, and you would see him, and you're like, come on, man, get in the truck. You know, he lived in Poke and Bean Projects, and he was just a nice, happy-go-lucky young man. I mean, he wasn't the most athletic kid on the team. He played baseball. He always ran his mouth, talked trash. But he was team quarterback. In his first year, he was the backup running back. And but that was my favorite little guy. You know, he would come hang out, and he was going through some difficult times at home. And I always taught him, look, you got to work for everything that you're trying to get out of life. Cause I know they need money and things like that. I would then say, no, you come to the house and whenever you need some money, you come and work. Cause at the end of the day, I don't ever want you to, be a guy to stand on the corner asking for something. Don't ever get no money for no dope dealers or anything like that. And so that's why I'm proud of him, because anytime he needed anything to provide for his sisters and brothers, if he didn't have it, he would, Coach Luke, you got some work? And he would come by the house and I'd figure out something, wash some windows or something, and to make some extra money. And that's what he would do. And so when I saw him, because he wasn't the most athletic of them all, because he had the hard work and dedication, and he became what he is right now today, I'm really proud of him.
You better be careful. People are going to get emotional. You're all soft in old age. You used to be a hip-hop maverick, but look at you, emotional and touched because of the wonderful story that you helped get to the pros because it's really nice. It's really nice.
But no, they'll tell you a different story because I was real hard on
them. Yeah, you were hard on all of them. You're telling the romantic story, but you were out there betting God knows how much on all those games against your hip-hop rapper friends.
No. Actually, I never betted on the game.
You never have?
No, because you get emotional in the games. You bet, you get emotional. I did. Let me take that back. In the early Hurricane days, I did bet on the games for a certain reason. But I took the money and I donated the money to the pastor. If I won the bet, I donated the money to the pastor.
Trick Daddy, Trick Daddy, that is not what you were doing with that money. Trick Daddy says that he bet $30,000 on one of those youth.
I wasn't, let me tell you, I wasn't the only person betting on games. There were other people going to the Bahamas putting their money on the games. I'll leave it like that.
That's it. We'll end it right there, buddy. It's good talking to you. It's always good catching up with you. Thank you for spending this time with me.
No problem. I appreciate it.
Our thanks to Luther Campbell. We will continue to go inside and outside of sports, just talking to interesting people. If you want to help us out and you want more of this free content, it is staying free because of the sponsors and because you are subscribing, rating, and reviewing. You are taking this flawed, stupid metric and you are showing ESPN that we know how to rate, subscribe, and review. Listening is kind of optional. Flawed. But have at it. Rate, review, and subscribe. Our thanks to Luther Campbell. Terry Crews is next week. The guy with the bouncing pecs, Brooklyn 99, Idiocracy. We will talk to Terry Crews next week.